Welcome to our third lecture in the Spring Colloquium Series. Professor Dallas Smythe, who most of you know, has had a distinguished career both in the university and in research, as well as governmental regulation communications. Dallas, specifically today, is going to talk to us about Canadian communications media of submission. And I think rather than reading his long list of publications, I assume all of you have been exposed to that.
Thank you, Bill. Since I was here last in December, I worked very hard and I produced a document which I don't have copies to give you, but I believe Leora is getting copies made. If she forgets, I hope you'll remind her, get copies made to distribute, because I'd like to have a few copies. And I gave away all the copies I had at the conference over the weekend. It's called Canadian Communications Media of Cultural Submission. I'm not going to read it, of course, but I wanted to comment about how I got into this and why I think it may be important as a vehicle for doing several things, explaining my kind of political, economic, analytical process, and also maybe throwing a little light on the dependency relationship culturally which this country has to the United States. Unfortunately, I won't be able to go through the detailed analysis on the second point, but I think it is important to emphasize the theoretical tools that I used rather than the detailed results. Maybe I'm wrong in that. And in questions, I'll be glad to try to deal with any of the factual aspects that you like. I don't assume that this is more than a kind of a first reconnaissance effort. I marked it working paper, not for publication, because I think I probably want to tear it up and do it over again. But it was a voyage of discovery for me to do it, and it was a shocking voyage. And to explain why, I have to explain that because I lived my first 12 years here and then was taken to the United States and grew up there and got my professional education there and so on, and then came back to here in 1963 to Canada and lived here ever since. I am a Canadian. I consider myself as passionately identified with Canada as any other nationalist in Canada. But I had not previous to this addressed myself analytically to the question of how dependent are we on the United States and how did we get this way? And what I found out shocked even me, and I thought I was fairly cynical about these things already. So it is a first groping exploratory study, and I hope to do better in the future. I've listed a number of questions at the end of it, of this document, which I think need exploration. Many of them are suitable for MA or PhD theses. I hope somebody might sometime, somewhere, get interested in doing something about them. And I don't know the answers to the questions I've asked. And there are a lot of questions I probably didn't include there that I should have. Well, first of all, let me deal with the question of the theoretical tools, because I think you're entitled in a departmental seminar when the faculty are sort of showing and telling to know what kinds of tools they bring to their work. I have taken other tools to my academic work in earlier decades. Now I'm taking the following tools, which I group together as sort of as the political economy of communications tools. The first is an historical materialist method. I'm concerned with the real world. I'm intensely interested in theory, but the theory must be applicable to the real world. I want to use it on the real world. I don't want to sit and contemplate the beauty of the theory in a vacuum. I'm not interested in that kind of theory at all. I hope that it is useful, and I intend to improve it on the basis of use, trying to practice the interaction of theory and practice. It is concerned with the historical reality, the material reality of how people actually are and live, rather than laboratory experiments about them. It's concerned with policies and structures, and that's the historical materialist method. The second element in this kit of tools is the central element of class struggle, the fact that societies are structured according to power relationships. There's a power structure. It is a class structure. A class structure, especially for a dependent nation, provides us with one of our most important tools for getting moving toward liberation, because the bourgeoisie, the comprador class, is in a divided role, as I'll indicate later. You just have to notice that Levesque spoke in New York last week to see the divisions within our ruling class and to realize that in Canada this opens the door for all kinds of new development, as well as closing the door on previous kinds of maldevelopment. The third kind of tool that I'm going to be using and always use is some kind of a theory of what makes the engines of capitalism go. It is not enough merely to look at class structures. It is not enough merely to look at an undifferentiated historical material record. It's important to analyze what elements in this structure give dynamism to it, make it go. And I think I have something to say on that later. And fourthly, it's important to keep the tool in mind of the role of ideology in connection with consciousness on a mass basis, and the relation of that ideology and consciousness to economic activity. Now, this is to raise the old Marxist bugaboo, if you want to let it get you down, about economic determinism, and I refuse to get hooked on any such bugaboo. As far as I'm concerned, consciousness can control, can direct the material infrastructure as well as be directed by it. The two are interactive. And we ought now, I think, to know enough about this to not fight that useless battle over again. Overall, the basic tool is the notion that nature is a dialectical process. It isn't random. It isn't like billiard balls colliding on a pool table top, a billiard table top. It's not like a mechanical tinker toy. It's a process of combinations and divisions, with the divisions being the direction in which growth takes place, and the combinations really being the direction in which death takes place. So those are the basic tools, and I think I should move directly into the discussion of the actual theory that I try to bring to bear on the Canadian scene. In the first place, what is the context, the world context of Canadian development? I think we need to be explicit about this. Harold Innes made a bona fide and great contribution in his work on the Canadian staples, which were, in his view, the basis of the Canadian development. But the Canadian staples were one element in a mercantilist system. And Innes frequently, if not most of the time, assumed that everybody knew about the mercantilist system because he did. He didn't write about it very much. He didn't talk about it. But the mercantilist system of his period was the direct lineal antecedent of the world imperialist system we have today. and it has many continuities. So that I now move to the question of what are the principal aspects of this world system of capitalism? And I have six that I want to mention to you. First of all, it is a wonderfully complicated structure of interrelated markets on a geographical, on every other kind of basis. It's a market structure interrelated for all kinds of raw materials, semi-finished goods, finished goods, services, capital, equipment, everything, you name it, it's included. The markets even include pictures of Chairman Mao's body being observed by people in Peking. Herb Schiller sent me a picture advertising Parade Weekly of showing Chairman Mao's body, and the caption was, "When anything important happens, Parade is there." And Schiller wrote on the ad, "Even Chairman Mao's body becomes a commodity." This is part of the market structure. It's an illustration of the extreme margins of the market structure. And the market structure is the guiding mechanism, the impersonal guiding mechanism, to the extent that it isn't fixed and controlled, by which resources are allocated and things get done. This is the nature of imperialism. Secondly, second characteristic is that the world is inhabited by national state structures under the control, in each case, of some kind of bourgeois class. In the case of the developing countries, by virtue of the fact that they are subordinate to an imperial core, their ruling class serves the function of compradors. Even if they are not only the ruling class who are employed by the multinational corporations. The third characteristic is that the landscape is dominated by the fact of the existence of multinational corporations, 200 or more of them, a great bulk of which are centered in the United States. And these multinational corporations conduct business activities within the capitalist sphere through which resources flow from the periphery to the core. In this case, the United States is the core today. So there's a one-way flow of resources. And this you can document if you look at what happens to retained earnings on the part of the multinationals in the dependent countries. We provide even the capital to exploit ourselves with through the multinational corporations. The fourth element is a world structure of communications plant and operations and policy, which is characterized by a one-way flow of information in all forms from the core to the periphery. We draw out resources from the periphery, we send out information to the periphery. The communications policy is characterized by the ideology of possessive individualism. Individual selfishness is the basis of it. But possessive individualism is linked in this ideology with the free flow of information, which means not only that information should flow unimpeded from the central core to the periphery, but that people should regard it as pluralistic. And the free marketplace of ideas, the doctrine from John Stuart Mill's on liberty, which was so central to the ideology of the Victorian British Empire, is equally central to the present-day empire. And another interesting characteristic of the communications policy is the promotion of a single language, which keeps on plugging away, English, as the world language of capitalism. It's not the only one, but it keeps getting plugged. The fifth characteristic is, I call your attention to, is the appropriation of labor surplus at three stages, where people actually work, at the level of the national compradors, and at the home office of the multinational corporations, so that there's three successive rip-offs. And the sixth and last of these characteristics that I want to mention is the fact that, as Chairman Mao said, countries want independence, nations want liberation, and people want revolution or change. And by this I'm referring to the fact that there is a reservoir of resistance to the domination from the core, a reservoir that speaks up for myriads of reasons, tradition, religion, the values of high culture of a traditional sort, whatever the reasons. There are plenty of reasons why peoples want, nations want liberation. The French are a beautiful example right here in Canada of this right now. They want independence and liberation. Well, those are the characteristics, I submit, that one has to bear in mind in looking at the context of Canadian development. And now, for the theory of the engine that makes the machine go. A little bit of theory about monopoly capitalism. There was a crisis of competitive capitalism in the second half of the last century. There was insecurity on the part of the capitalists. There was dog-eat-dog competition. They were insecure in regard to resources because, as far as labor was concerned, they had taken over into the factories when they established them in the Industrial Revolution in England, the United States, Canada, on the continent. They'd taken over workers who were all-around workers, skilled workers, from the old domestic or putting-out system tradition, workers who knew their craft, who were master craftsmen. Merely putting them into the walls, inside the walls of a factory, didn't change the fact that these guys knew more than the management did about how to produce things. And that was the source of insecurity for management if your workers know more than you do about the productive process. When those workers were organized, as they became by the middle of the 19th century, into unions which were highly politically oriented, which were talking about revolution, there was a real danger that Marx's predictions in the mid-century might be realized. There was a revolutionary movement in Europe in 1848. It scared the pants off of the businessmen, including the Americans and Canadians, who thought it might happen here too. So they were insecure in that respect. They were insecure in respect to raw materials because, lacking vertically integrated industrial organization, they were at the mercy of their suppliers. And if you're going to develop large-scale manufacturing operations with heavy overhead costs, you don't want this kind of risk. You want to have a secure labor force and a secure source of raw materials. So on the production resources side, they were insecure. On the end product side, marketing their products, they were insecure. Why? Brand names were not in great use, hardly used at all. There was little advertising of this display advertising of the kind we know now. And there was a great deal of competition. Commodities circulated in those days. They didn't get sucked up directly from the factory to the outlet as they do today. And that was risky for the individual entrepreneur, because when you came to a period of a business crisis and depression, as happened, you look at the 19th century, you see that about every 7 to 10 or 11 years, there was an acute business crisis and liquidation phase, and depression meant price cutting. And as businessmen grew to have heavier and heavier capital investments, overhead costs were higher, the incentive was greater to do cutthroat pricing in order to try to stave off bankruptcy during a period of declining business. And that was very unsettling because the mortality rate on business enterprises was high. Alfred Marshall, writing in the 1890s, used to assume that the life expectancy of a business enterprise might be, what, in the order of 10, 20 years. He didn't assume it went on in perpetuity. So it was a risky business, being a capitalist in that period. And there was a tremendous pressure brought on these people by the fact that with the improvements in science and engineering, they knew how to build larger scale mass production facilities, which potentially could cut costs greatly as compared to the earlier stages of the factory system, and which would yield fantastic profits, provided they could cure their problems about insecurity on purchases of materials and labor and sales of products. They had a systemic dilemma, and they solved it unconsciously on the principle of dialectics of one goes into two. They divided the problem, and the solution was like the two blades of a pair of scissors, if you keep that analogy in mind as I go ahead. The objective was to control bodies, and incidentally minds, on the production front, and to control minds, and incidentally bodies, on the consumption front. Those are the twin objectives of monopoly capitalism, which could only be realized when large-scale enterprises, highly mechanized, could control and manage demand through advertising and substitute the suction of commodities for the circulation of commodities. So that the system required and invented mass media. And the first mass media to be invented were the newspapers and the magazines. Yellow journalism of the 1880s and 90s was the name which the vocational people give to this kind of thing, but from a business point of view, it was the period when advertising became the principal support of the mass media. The mass media had previously had a principal product which was news, which was entertainment, which was information. But when the principal basis of support shifted to advertising, you had to have some other explanation of what the product was. I got into this whole particular kind of analysis by being nagged by the question, what is the principal product of the commercially advertiser-supported mass media? Is it the programs? Is it the entertainment? Is it the news? The answer is no. That's not the principal product. That's just the free lunch. That's the come-on, which is provided in order that you can be counted as part of an audience. Why? Because the audience is what is sold. That's what the advertiser pays money for to the mass media operator. And that's the dynamic which makes the monopoly capitalist system function. As Schiller pointed out last Friday, the program, the editorial content, is not a neutral one. It is part of the selling process. It is part of the brain conditioning process for the audience. But it is not the principal product of the media. One of the beautiful characteristics of this system was that people became so mind-managed that they didn't notice that not only were they working for free for the advertiser when they did the marketing of the goods, it's a do-it-yourself marketing system, but that they were putting up not only the prices, the money to pay for the goods the advertisers persuaded them they needed, but they were putting up the capital investment to receive the advertising, which they would then work at. I did a simple calculation of the comparative investment and operating costs of the business enterprises and the CBC on the media production side and the audience investment in radio and TV receivers and the cost of maintaining and operating them. And the audience investment is 5 to 1 as against the investment of industry in Canada. 5 times as big an investment by you all across Canada in your TV and radio receivers as is invested in all of the TV stations, networks, cable systems, and so forth. 5 to 1. And on an annual operating basis, the ratio is 3 to 1. You pay 3 times as much as they do to bring yourselves the advertising which you then dutifully work at. The mass media were the essential instruments which were created by monopoly capitalism. They were not in our genes. They were not in some primordially determined technology. They were a systemic invention. And they were brought in to make the marketing process succeed. It would have been impossible to dispose of mass-produced goods absent this. Can you imagine Tupperware parties enough to get rid of them all? Can you imagine door-to-door salesmen enough to push all these commodities? Can you imagine any other mechanism than getting people to do it for themselves? And when you stand in line at the supermarket having done this, work for the advertiser, think about the fact that this is service which you're rendering, which is paid for by the advertiser. You don't get the pay. The stations and the newspapers get the pay. But it's labor that you're doing, which is paid for. Well, the MNCs managed to structure the system so that it works for both the civilian sales and the military sales, as Baran and Sweezy point out. And this is the season of the year in the United States and the period in the four-year cycle down there when the military sales effort is being particularly skillfully attended to by the system. There's the appreciations of the... It's old hat to talk about a missile gap now, but they're saying the same thing in every other way that they can. The Russians are way ahead of us, so there has to be a bigger appropriation for the military. That's the way the media conduct this military sales effort, the civilian sales effort I've been talking about, and it's obvious. Well, that's the kind of system we're talking about, and this is the kind of tool that I think is useful to use in analyzing it. And I define cultural imperialism as all the tools by which this scissors is applied to the minds and bodies and resources and institutions of all of the countries outside the core country. We're not the only one so treated, of course. In my paper, there's a treatment of the ruling class, the Canadian compradors, and nationalism. I'm going to skip commenting on it. And I'd like to just give you a little illustration of the way in which I use this apparatus, and then I'll pause and ask you to ask questions. And the illustration will be drawn from our mass media in particular. Our book and magazine publishing industry in Canada is a typical colonial operation. It's largely controlled directly from our successive imperial cores, first Great Britain, and then from the United States. It's thoroughly dedicated to the free flow of information doctrine. If you read the Royal Commission hearings, reports, you must be as impressed as I am by the fact that the commissioners seem to be more concerned with defending the free flow principle than they are in defending Canadian publishing. There is a constant rationalization of why we cannot interfere with the free flow of commodities through the markets. The fact that the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, Ireland have managed to interfere and still be capitalist countries doesn't occur to the Canadian ruling class when it comes to this very important area of our superstructure. No wonder our textbooks are usually foreign written. It would be amazing and incredible if they weren't, given this permissiveness. The Canadian film industry has, almost from its inception, been a subsidiary of U.S. film MNC. In broadcasting, the only segment of Canadian industry in which there is explicit national requirement of Canadian ownership, the extent of 80% or more, is in broadcasting operation. The possible exception of the banking industry where it's done on a case-by-case basis and they say no to everybody, or almost everybody who wants to get in under the roof. In the case of broadcasting, it's very interesting that the CRTC, therefore, is the example par excellence in which it is possible in Canada for pro-nationalist, anti-dependency forces to expect to be able to make some use of government apparatus because of the fact of Canadian national ownership requirements and the fact that our national bourgeoisie is not monolithic, is not without divisions, and it is possible, therefore, to work through and on those people at that level. That's at the operating level. At the level of standards, specifications, and frequency allocation, Canada has had no autonomy in radio and television at all, from the beginning. Our standards were set by the same people in the United States and Canada. Same people being the Radio Television Manufacturers Association with scores of committees, coordinate their activities across firm lines and which make recommendations. In the United States, they make them to the FCC and they press the FCC to accept them. Then in Canada, their subsidiaries of the MNCs in the United States make the same representations through the comparable committees which are advisors to the Department of Communications, or earlier the Department of Transport in Canada. And so it is that the standards for black and white television, which were adopted after the war, were identical with the standards in the United States. Are you surprised? Now, England and France didn't adopt the same standards. Germany and France didn't adopt the same standards. Result, each of those countries has an electronic curtain which defends its culture against the others. If Canada had adopted the French or the English standards for black and white television, then it wouldn't have mattered that 54% of our TV households are able to receive American programs directly because they couldn't have received them. They could have received them indirectly through the CBC, which would take them at the gateways and transcode them into Canadian standards and distribute them to Canadians. But Canada would then have been in control of its own television policy. It has not been in control since black and white was innovated. Color was more of the same. And the interesting thing about it is that there's no record that I've been able to find of when and where this decision was made. No social scientist has commented on this fact of this decision. In the case of Yugoslavia, they had the same problem in an acute form in the 1950s. If they adopted Western standards, the PAL standards, the German standards, which were, I think, also adopted in Italy, weren't they, Bill? If they adopted the PAL standards, then they opened themselves to a flood of programming and advertising from the West. And they built a wall between themselves and the Soviet bloc, because Soviet signals wouldn't be receivable by Yugoslav sets built on PAL standards. If they adopted the Soviet standards, the reverse would be true. They'd have built a wall on the West, and they'd have opened up the East. They made a decision in favor of the PAL standards, but they at least made a public record of the fact that they made such a decision and at the highest level of government. I don't suppose that the highest level of government in Canada ever thought there was anything to make a decision about. It was made routinely, just like our military was routinely coordinated with the American military from 1918 on. We gave up control of our effective communications policy and our military between 1918 and 1945. And these are the two characteristics of a sovereign state, that you control your own communications and you control your own army, for God's sake. If you don't control these two, you're not a sovereign state. And the Massey Commission recognized this in its rhetoric, but didn't recognize the extent to which the horse was gone from the barn before they'd ever come into existence. Well, I'll try to close this up rather quickly. I'm fascinated by what can be learned from the whole Canadian Radio League campaign to establish the CBC. It's a fascinating thing to look at analytically now. How come the CBC, which is the finest flower of Canadian cultural autonomy, and I'm not being sarcastic, it historically has been, was only undertaken to be created after the period of time in which it could conceivably could have made a significant difference to the future of Canada. It was 50 years too late as a cultural venture. Now, you may say there wasn't any radio before 1918, but they could have done the same kind of thing with publications 50 years before and didn't. The fact is, the critical period in electronic communication in Canada was the 8 years before the Aird Commission, not the period since. It was the period after broadcasting had been started on the American model with set manufacturers promoting it for the sake of the profits they'd get out of selling sets, and phonograph record companies cooperating with it because it boosted their sales, and local merchants cooperating with it because they got local publicity, and advertisers coming in on the act to cash in on it when the audiences got big enough. That was the American system, and that was followed in Canada without any letter hindrance for 8 solid years in the formative years in the 20s, so that most Canadians listened to American programs, many Canadians, a high proportion, listened to American programs on radio coming through American stations in Canada. And then along came a bunch of very agitated, very honest, sincere Canadians of the ruling class, Sir Robert Borden, Aird himself, Arthur Meehan, the former Prime Minister. The list is monumental of people that backed public broadcasting in Canada in the 30s. And it got monumental support, too. Graham Spry, Plante, Claxton went out, organized, and they were very skillful organizers. They were, from the upper class themselves, but they were very skillful organizers, and they tapped the reservoirs of dissatisfaction, discontent culturally in the working class, and the churches, and the farms, and they did a magnificent job of organizing, including in Quebec, for the support of this. And they generated a tremendous amount of public opinion and support for public broadcasting, and they eventually got the CBC organized. But on what basis? In order to be secure, the CBC had to rest on license fees, and the Aird Commission had so recommended. They never got a situation in which the CBC was supported on the basis of license fees. CBC always had to carry some advertising, even in the beginning. Second condition necessary for a successful CBC, that all except perhaps the smallest community radio stations had to be public stations. That was never satisfied either. And the newspaper-owned and independent radio stations with regional and even clear channel power were permitted to continue on the air. The result was that their control over their audiences, both through propaganda which they put out and through the propaganda of the deed, their advertising that they carried, in time eroded the support of CBC. Why was it possible to get the CBC created, even with these weaknesses, in the 1930s? The answer would please an orthodox Marxist, although I was surprised to find that this, I think, is the answer. And you find it in Frank Peer's book on the politics of broadcasting. I think the answer is that in the 1930s, in the beginning, the bulk of the Canadian newspapers committed themselves to supporting public broadcasting, to supporting what became the CBC. They devoted their news columns to it and their editorial columns to it. They gave very favorable publicity to the Canadian Radio League. They were allies of it. They were activists in it. Dafoe, however he pronounces it, in Winnipeg, was one of the leaders in the Canadian Broadcasting League. The newspapers were leading, and, you know, with control of the agenda of people's attention over the air, this was very effective propaganda. But why did they do it? Because they wanted to prevent radio from being a competitor of the newspapers for advertising revenue. They said so privately, and it comes out in Pierre's book. They changed their minds when radio became profitable enough toward the end of the 30s. And they're, one by one, they dropped off and joined the opposition, and they found their political spokesman in the Social Credit and the PC Party in the 40s. From then on, it was all downhill for the CBC because the support eroded for ever getting control of all the stations and financing it on the basis of license fees. And absent that, you had to go over the American system. A revealing example of the venality, to use the ugly word, of the newspapers is reported in the Canadian magazine Marketing. I'm quoting from Frank Pierce, which is nothing less than blackmail. And anybody in a journalism school who talks to students about the sanctity of freedom of the press and the separation of what goes on in the newsroom from the what goes on in the front in the back office should be reminded of this. This was at a time when the CBC was trying to get more money, as it always was. And the CBC wanted to up the license fees. This was about 1939. Here's what Marketing magazine said. There had been meetings between CBC officials and newspaper owners. A constructive suggestion was made that if the CBC would seek to secure its needed additional revenue by increasing the license fee on radio sets, the press would stand back of it and help the public realize that such an increase was just and necessary. Semicolon. Otherwise, the press would have to consider the advisability of revealing what the CBC is doing in flooding Canada with United States programs. I never saw a more candid expression of a blackmail threat than that. And that is the kind of pressure which greased the skids under the CBC, in my opinion. Anyway, the result of a whole dismal succession of pronouncements, including that of the Fowler Commission in 1957, urging the CBC to carry more advertising, and again in 1965, when the Fowler Committee urged the CBC to seek 25% of the advertising market, was that you get the kind of statistics which are on the blackboard. And I put them there because they represent to me the fact that the CBC today in Canada is the functional equivalent of the public broadcasting system in the United States. They show that in the English language program service, the share of audience enjoyed by the CBC programs, whether they're CBC or private stations on the network in television, was 29%. At the end of 1971, dropped off to 23% in 1975. I think that's a significant drop, even allowing for the fact that you're probably dealing with rather high sampling errors in this kind of data. And in radio, CBC program service is less than 10%, 7 or 8%. You know, it's really trivial. When you consider that 23% of television includes the audience for the American-produced advertising-supported programs that are carried by CBC, and that represents, what, 75-80% of the total program service in the evening hours? Then take that proportion of 29-28%, and you're looking at maybe 6 or 7% of the viewing audience attending to the non-imported, Canadian-originated television programs on the English language program service. Look, by contrast, at the difference in the French. the program share is immensely bigger, very significantly bigger. In 1975, it's more than twice as big as the share of the English program service. And even on radio, the French is significantly bigger. Moreover, it's growing in both cases. There's something interesting here to go into, and this is just a little fever thermometer that you can insert in the body politic here to see what is happening. Well, what are the implications of this? I must draw this to a close. I didn't mean to talk so long. First of all, if monopoly capitalism produces and therefore controls the bulk of the minds of the population and the bulk of the bodies, and if consciousness is central, then demystification is a tactical objective of liberation of those minds and bodies. And demystification must begin, I submit, with the demystification of the ideology. It does no good to talk to people about isolated facts when the facts have their significance from the preconceptions about the nature of society that people have. If people think that a nation is a statistical total of discrete, selfish individuals and nothing more, then no statistical fact is going to impress them with the wrongness of the existing oppression. They have to see that the ideological foundations can and should be questioned. The principal contradiction in Canada is between the Canadian working people and the imperial core mediated by the Canadian compradors. That's another conclusion I draw. And the grounds of the struggle must be where the action is, at the level of people who are being screwed by the monopoly capitalist system. I've mentioned the fact that I think the CRTC and Royal Commissions are a wonderful opportunity to exercise leverage in this matter. My paper points out that interventions before such commissions to be effective have to be conceived and executed with some kind of tactical and strategic coherence as to the results which are expected. If such interventions are merely formalistic interventions without such consequences being expected and planned for, they are, in most cases, I think, merely reaffirming the status quo by legitimizing the exercise. As to the substance of what can be done in regard to Canadian cultural autonomy, I'm optimistic enough to think that the long catalog of things of a very bourgeois nature that could have been done 50 years ago to make Canada autonomous were not done, but still ought to be floated and tried in connection with royal commissions and real people. For example, getting a system of distribution of Canadian books and magazines that is handled under state subvention and various other methods in other small countries. It is still worth doing in this country, regardless of what kind of a political system we have. It needs to be done. We should look at the catalog of things that could have been done and were not done, and consider them tactically in relation to the possibilities of doing things now and in the future. And lastly, 2 points. One, I think the significance of the workers in the communications industry, in the newspapers, the magazines, radio and television particularly, needs to be fully recognized in connection with this matter of cultural domination. Because these people have many reasons to be concerned about it. They see this in their work. They get schizophrenic about it in their work. They are articulate because it's part of their professional capacity to be articulate. They are strung across the country like a string of beads. And if there's one thing that is needed by the proponents of Canadian nationalism, it is some kind of communications network across the country amongst themselves. And the communications workers provide a potential marvelous communications network. they need to be organized and encouraged into mutual cooperation. I know I made a talk like this to a seminar in Regina just a week ago, and there was a woman there from the press, and she said, "Oh, this is so important. I got to have you come and talk to all the newspaper workers in Saskatchewan." Okay, the last point is about consciousness raising. And just to put myself on public record, if it's necessary, about this, that there are many roads to consciousness raising. I am particularly concerned about the tendencies in communication software and hardware to think that anything that is done to develop this, use of this stuff automatically raises consciousness. The question that needs to be asked, in my opinion, is what kind of consciousness? Individual consciousness or consciousness of systemic relations and of the possibility of systemic change? If it is the former, it isn't as much a cop-out as psychedelic drugs or going off on self-sufficient farms into the interior is. That's all, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Small capitalist work as in relationship to the national question and to Quebec?
Well, in North America, under monopoly capitalism, there aren't very many people who draw their paycheck and never have to work. Some of them work very hard, true in others. Wall Street bankers, I think, work extremely hard, much harder than university professors do, and probably earn their keep more than we do from the system. They're better clients in a way, but they are very productive to the system. I don't know how to deal with this question of Marxist treatment of work under capitalism, under monopoly capitalism. I think it has to be re-examined. I don't think if you call it problematic as a worker working on piecework on a production line, making telephones or radios in Canada for a multinational of the United States, is in a very clear or ambiguous position on this. I also don't think that housewives working and not getting paid, and all kinds of people who are working unpaid as marketing agents for capitalism because the time has been sold by advertising. The treatment of them is worth it. I think it has to be completely considered. The time you spend doing your marketing in the grocery store, which in the 19th century would have been shortened by the fact that a clerk would have handed over the counter stuff to you on request. He would have done the scurrying around. He would have known where it was. You didn't have to go looking for it. Now you have to go looking for it. You do the marketing work for him. You choose. How can you choose if it weren't for advertising? All this work has to be somehow brought under a reconsidered concept of work. I don't know how it'll work, how it'll come out. What was the first thing you mentioned I wanted to...
What I mean is that what are class boundaries in advanced capitalist society? What indeed are nations within a capitalist imperialist chain? Because I don't think that's the same way about Canadian national autonomy is.
I'm very glad you brought that up because you see, I think a great deal of the Canadian view about problems vis-a-vis autonomy is a pipe dream. I think our autonomy was lost 50 years or 70 years ago, and we don't know it. We're living in a dream world when we talk as if it hadn't been on. When we don't control our own military and our own communications, we've lost our autonomy. And you can back it up with all the statistics you want on interpenetration of the financial community. It isn't a one-way street. Canadian capitalists are all mixed up in the United States. The second largest source of investment in the United States from outside the United States comes from Canada. The UK accounts for 21% of foreign investment in the United States in 1974. Canada accounts for 20%. Over $5 billion of Canadian money invested down there. This is owned by Canadians and therefore is example of integration, the assimilation. I keep asking myself, how is Canada different from California or the state of Washington vis-a-vis the rest of the country? California has its own banks, its own banking centers of capital and control. Canada does. So does Washington. So does Oregon. In what respect economically are we disengaged from them? I know one respect in which we are. We are a source of special privilege to the monopolist capitalist corporations in Canada. If it were seriously proposed that Canada should be formally annexed to the United States, how do you think that the Canadian subsidiaries of the American multinationals would feel about it? They'd lose their antitrust exemption. They'd lose the privilege of having interlocking directorates amongst themselves, which they can do freely now. They'd lose all kinds of tax concessions, tariff concessions. They would hate it. They would be the most devout and ardent advocates of Canadian nationalism we can find, next to the federal civil servants, who would likewise become redundant if the word mission changed to take place. I think turning the problem inside out and asking it that way is a very useful way to look at it, to see who would mind, or the Canadian Legion would mind. You know, and a similar cultural group would mind. But apart from the Canadian federal establishment, I don't think it matters, the provincial establishment, government establishment, they function just as well as the state as the province. And they're necessary in both cases.